birds and the killer bees. From the long tail coming, there's someone swarming with the bees. Birds and the killer bees.
When the MCs came to live out their name, inscribed in the halls and the walls of fame, balancing life, wrote both the yin and yang. Hands buried the man and they raised the sun to rain. That's a play on words, they say herb ain't all the same. Slaves in prison and they some unchained. While everybody in my gang is star DJ Prame, screaming through the sunroof, money still ain't a thing. While I'm spinning small bank, asking where's my change. Carpool with the homie, saving gas in my tank. I think like a billionaire, I spend less than I make. Strong minded, I should bench way more than my weight. Women been leading the way since Roxanne, Shantae, and the unit have Flav and Jay have Marcy neighbors that wave. Looking confused, I'm like, cool, maybe it's age. When I see Afro puffs, I think maybe it's rage. Maybe it's stage, they tripping and they say they got beef. Ain't an MC on this earth that make me feel afraid. Wu-Tang for the children, that's a scripture and phrase. See my goals from a bird's view like Trey, underage.
When the MCs came to live out the day, some hay, slow cocaine, act the same. Rock it all, now all to the electro planes. Spark the brain, the building to be born.
Chisel on the track. When I'm so off the radar, it's very hard to find me. In space, a selfie with the earth behind me. You follow the leader, the track is off the meter. A lot of rap is weak, low frequency in the tweeters. Very inaudible, clock radio speakers. Quietly whispering is a whirl of wiki leakers. Forget the gaudiness, my method is nauseous. Transferring ideas into the brains of the audience. The street poet gave a special art form. Global reach, you earn your ears in your heart by giving the local speech. Wonder what words is potent as a sorcery. Not witchcraft, but a list of terms in the glossary. Well-written rap, bound to have a great impact on the listener, for the fact is well intact. An MC should electrify, beautify, strive to empower, inspire, transform the worldview.
Back in the days when niggas wore fades, silk tie caps, just trying to catch a wave. Trying to catch a wave. Trying to catch a wave. Thinking like back in the days when niggas wore fades.
Cigarettes make me nervous, and I turn butter into wine. And I called you on purpose, 'cause I know you've got the time.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting live from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Bitson.
Today we broadcast in the Jiajiaque, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:04.
Today we have an interview with Julie Michaud. Julie Michaud is the outreach coordinator for the Centre Gender Advocacy. In association with Concordia University, the centre aims to fight gender oppression by spearheading progressive projects and offering support in resources along with services. Such services and resources include trans advocacy services, safer injection and drug use supplies, as well as safer sex products. However, in our interview with Julie today, we mainly discuss the two ongoing projects, which are the Mapping Project and Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Before we air our interview with Julie, we will play the final 10 minutes of last week's interview with Professor Elsaji. We want to issue content warnings for both interviews. Professor Elsaji's interview discusses Islamophobia and colonialism, and our interview with Julie Michaud discusses colonialism along with gender-based violence. Stay tuned for our weekly headline roundup after the song. Right now we're playing Nervous by Joni Anno. After, we're going to play Annie Forever by Ducks Unlimited. That was Nervous by Joni Anno featuring Bad Bad Not Good, and then we played Annie Forever by Ducks Unlimited. The time now is 5:09, and now it's time for our weekly headline roundup.
dated February 7th, an open letter from the students to oppose graduate option suspension has been circling around the McGill community's interweb. Addressed to the deans of the university, this letter is a petition of sorts from McGill students, written to oppose the proposed suspension of the graduate options in gender and women's studies and development studies by the Office of the Dean of Arts. The decision has caused a mass controversy in regards to the lack of transparency from the arts department and the stripped opportunity of undergraduate and graduate students pursuing these programs alike. The letter addresses the 26 current master's and PhD students who are enrolled in the program who have not been consulted regarding the suspension. It recognizes how this suspension would, quote, adversely affect the curriculum of our graduate programs, unquote, here at McGill. The letter is open to graduate, undergraduate, and faculty signatories. The link to its Google Doc will be posted on our Twitter after the show, so make sure to sign it and include your faculty if you care about the cause.
Montreal Mayor Valerie Plante said her administration has revised an existing renovation program to encourage landlords to renovate rentals amidst the city's housing crisis. As of Monday's decree and beginning on April 1st, owners of low-rise apartment buildings in Montreal are eligible for subsidies up to $14,000 per unit and $500,000 per building. These subsidies will be available for buildings of five stories or less with at least six units and can be used for renovations and improvements to make buildings more environmentally sustainable. Plante attributes the revision, quote, in the context of the housing shortage, unquote. Furthermore, the previous program only paid out $800,000 annually and was not focused on the problems of today, such as affordable rent housing.
This morning, Environment Canada issued a smog alert for Montreal. This warns of a high concentration of pollutants expected, resulting in poor air quality, especially in urban areas where emissions are higher. This smog alert has been contributed to wood-burning stoves, which is the main source of fine particles that contribute to smog during the winter. As of late, the smog can also be blamed on the high concentration of motorized vehicles in the Greater Montreal area. This smog warning is supposed to persist until this evening. It is recommended that you stay inside if you have a history with heart disease or respiratory ailments. Pardon me.
Protests against the building of a pipeline on the Wet'suwet'en territory are springing up around Canada, with Ontario getting its most notable demonstration this weekend. First Nations members of the Mohawk Territory blocked the Via Rail tracks in Belleville, Ontario, in opposition of British Columbia's Coastal GasLink pipeline. These are two of the busiest routes in Belleville, and they affect services between Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal. Via Rail said on Sunday that 18 of the trains had been cancelled for the weekend, with today being the fourth day protests have ensued on the tracks. Standing in solidarity with Northwest BC Indigenous folks, the Mohawk peoples were protesting the 670-kilometer pipeline that is proposed to cut through Wet'suwet'en territory. In BC, RCMP officers have been arresting people for breaching a court injunction related to this pipeline. The CN has since said that it has received an injunction to remove protesters from the Ontario site.
That was our weekly headline roundup. Next, we're playing the last 10 minutes of our interview with Professor Al Saji, but first, a quick song.
What the hell? could paint the sky like a photo, yeah. And baby, we should never know, but if we don't, if we won't try. We could live a life full of color. If you won't, let me know. We'll escape through pigeonhole. It's our world, so go, girl, let's get it on.
Well, I know there's only time, but let me see what's on your mind. I could see what's on your mind.
What's on your mind?
Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was Still Woozy with Lucy featuring Odie. The time now is 5:15.
So now it's time for the last 10 minutes of our interview with Professor Al-Saji. Two Fridays ago, the Islamic Studies Institute held an event titled Islamophobia as Racism. Associate Professor of Philosophy Al-Saji provided a critical phenomenology of Muslim women's racialization at the event. We spoke to Professor Al-Saji about her research at McGill, why she chose to speak about Muslim women's racializations two Fridays ago, and the sociopolitical climate in regards to racism in the province of Quebec. Once again, we want to issue a content warning as this interview discusses Islamophobia and colonialism. We hope you enjoy.
Wearing religious signs or the hijab is that it's oppressive and therefore it needs banned. Another argument that people give is often about secularism, that it, you know, in secular space you have to empty out or cleanse secular space of all of these religious signs. So because the racialization goes through other means, other tools, that means that the racism or the racialization itself remains hidden. Right, because what people talk about or what ostensibly they're doing is passing a secular law. Right, they can argue that this law is about secularism, that it's not specifically targeting religion. Now I don't think that's the case. I think it is targeting religion. I think in particular it's targeting not just religion in general, but the gendered bodies of Muslim women who embody are wearing the hijab. And so I wanted to look at how racialization, that kind of hidden racialization, that kind of everyday racialization takes place, and specifically look at Muslim women because I think that's a large part of the targeted population in Quebec right now. With Bill 21, right? Bill 21.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So I just want to say, I'll just add one last thing, which is I don't think that means that it's only Muslim women who wear the hijab who are targeted. So I think there's a kind of atmosphere of suspicion that ends up, affecting and the way people see Muslim women in general. And so there tends to be ways in which Muslim women who don't wear the hijab are also policed in terms of what they wear or what kind of religious signs they're expressing or how much religion they're expressing or even how much politicized views they're expressing. So there's the racialization extends further than just women who wear the hijab, but I think they tend to be the ones who are specifically targeted by laws in different places.
Okay. And lastly, how can students at McGill foster an environment for respectful and productive allyship?
So I think that's a really good question and a difficult one. It's not actually as obvious, right? It's not actually as obvious as it might seem. I do think there can be counterproductive campaigns sometimes that don't take into account what Muslims themselves would want. And also, I mean, we have to be careful because obviously Muslims don't agree amongst themselves, so it's not like all Muslim women will agree on what should be done. So you can't just sort of ask one person and then go by that. But I do think it's important that whatever policies, whatever whatever campaigns take place, do start from the people affected and who by, for example, Bill 21. So start with Muslim women, start with people who are being excluded. And it's not, just to be clear, obviously it's not just Muslim women. Jewish lines are also excluded, right? There's a fair bit of ways in which the Islamophobia is also overlaps with anti-Semitism, right? In Quebec, I think. I think it's important to start with sort of campaigns in terms of what Muslims might want. I think that the sort of protests and strikes are really good ways of trying to make a difference. I think it is quite like it. Obviously, this needs to be broader than McGill, because McGill tends to be seen as an Anglophone enclave in many ways and not taken seriously in terms of what people say about laws in Quebec, if you see what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So it is important to involve the Francophone universities, and how much that's possible, I don't know, but different universities will have different kinds of politicized student populations. So obviously there's a sense in which I don't know if what you're asking about is specifically Bill 21 or Islamophobia more generally, I think there's a sense in which it's important not to isolate Islamophobia mm-hmm. as just the one kind of racism, but link it up to other racisms that are at stake, and also understand that very often when Islamophobia will intersect with anti-Black racism because of the different ways in which Muslim populations end up being racialized, right? So even if we're talking about Middle Easterners, we're not all of one color. So it's kind of important that the image of who is being racialized here not become monolithic, right? That different intersections be allowed, opened up, taken into account, and that means hearing a lot of different voices in terms of what needs to be done. But I think the situation right now is sort of quite. I do think the situation in Quebec is quite dire because of the notwithstanding clause. It's going to be a certain period of time before things go through the courts, if that's the way that. That people want to go, but it's likely we may have to wait for another election, and elections don't always end up with the most progressive outcome. So yeah. I'm a bit of a pessimist in terms mm-hmm. of how things turn out. But I do think that activism on the ground can make a difference for how mm-hmm. people feel supported. And how they can feel a sense of of allyship, of support, and of being sustained in what it is a pretty long term fight. So I think the important thing is that I think I do have something to say here, which is I think that maybe the important thing isn't just simply what can be achieved through the courts or waiting for another election or trying to change the mind of politicians, which all should be things that can be done. There can be a diversity of strategies. But I think one of the important things is affectively that people who are targeted by the law, and also Muslims in Quebec, don't feel isolated. That is, mm-hmm. that that there's a sense in which there is, I would say, not just from this law, but all going back quite a bit in Quebec, that there is a sense of a feeling of hostility, that this is a kind of hostile world that one lives in for Muslims. I think it's also a hostile world, obviously, for Indigenous people. It's also a hostile world for, it's also a hostile anti-Black world, so it's not just Muslims. But I do think there's a sense in which having a sense of allyship, potentially, I would say, among racialized groups, can help in terms of how this pans out, can help in terms of how one can affectively keep living in a hostile world, which is by itself a difficult thing to sustain. So it's a bit of a, that's not the sort of optimism that says there's going to be a solution, but that is a way in which I think I would describe how lived experience can become something, how the experience of society currently in Quebec can become livable rather than just always feeling it as something that wears you down from day to day all the time. So, yeah.
That was the final minutes of our interview with Professor Al-Sadli. Stay tuned. We'll be playing our interview with Julie Mouchard after a quick music break. Enjoy.
With the arena, now I'm happy at the pizzeria, forgetting these worries, that's the idea, thinking I don't need the genie, got the keys to the Kia,
not sponsored,
and it's the color of sunshine, cruise, just lay back, unwind, I'm feeling in my prime, divine, funny how I still forget gratitude sometimes, but listen, if you need the flash, man, that's scary. Spending cash on these burdens that you can't carry. That's paperweight. You could chase it to the Ritz. You'll never find something sweeter than a raspberry. All your nice clothes take you to the cleaners. Biting off the top, still a bottom feeder. You're greener than the grass that you think is greener. I'd rather hang back with the real dreamers. I paid a visit to the pack. Trade a mixer for some caps. If we dose, then we do-si-do. No placebo clouds, we don't see those. And no doubt the vino flows free when we go out to see shows. Keep running into all these bros. Could you please lay aside your egos? Appreciate the love, but please don't be passing me your mixtapes, man. I really don't need those. Y'all got more offcuts than Home Depot. Well, not all of you. I'm just not trying to hear demos at the rendezvous. And peace signs to the knockoffs. How I'm dealing with these fakes like a prop shot. And no association with the shock jocks. Nah, no drama, just jaw with the top box.
Bye.
All right. Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was Andrew Hang with Summertime Feeling. And the time is now 5:30. So it's time for our interview with Julie Michaud. And we spoke to Julie about two ongoing projects, which are the Mapping Project and Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. We want to issue a content warning as Julie discusses colonialism along with gender-based and racialized violence. We hope you enjoy.
Firstly, would you mind quickly summarizing the mission of the Center Gender Advocacy?
Sure. We are a feminist organization. We're a fee levy group, which means that we're funded by students who go to Concordia University. And we are specifically an organization that has an intersectional approach, meaning that we are thinking through the ways that the different oppressions that people face, dependent on their identities and circumstances, intersect and sometimes have a greater impact than the sum of the individual oppressions. We do a lot of work on trans rights. We have a solidarity campaign on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans and two-spirit people. And essentially, we do a lot of different things that all relate in one way or another to fighting some kind of gender oppression.
And secondly, would you mind stating your role specifically at Center for Gender Advocacy?
I'm the outreach coordinator, which means that I take care of promoting the different events and services that we offer. And letting people know about what we do.
So currently you guys are working on something known as the Mapping Project. What is this project? How did it come about? And what was it that created a need for this project?
So the Mapping Project is a climate survey that is looking at how well Concordia University is doing regarding the inclusion of LGBT plus and or disabled students, and we are collecting data and experiences about this topic through a variety of means, including an online survey, in-person interviews, and focus groups, and we're asking students about their experiences, both in their classes, in the services that they access at Concordia, and even things like, what is covered in the course curricula. Is it inclusive of students with those identities or not? Are there specific barriers to those students? And the idea is that once we've collected this kind of data, that we can really assess it and figure out where improvements could be made so that Concordia could be as supportive an institution as possible for all students.
And so talking about like inclusion, so the Mapping Project aims to address three major societal barriers for LGBTQ2S+ community. One of said barriers being a systemic barrier. So what specifically do you aim to address when it comes to systemic issues?
Well, that can be a lot of different things, but certainly, universities and most institutions for that matter tend to be designed without really thinking of people who have needs or experiences that are outside the quote-unquote norm. So, when we think about making something accessible or thinking about, who our audience is, a lot of us tend to start with this idea, this, like, supposedly neutral idea of a person who is straight and cisgender and doesn't have any disabilities, or none that we know of anyway. And so I think part of addressing those systemic barriers is kind of flipping that and beginning from a place of making sure that people who are a little bit more at the margins are factored in from the very early decision-making whether that's the creation of curricula or the creation of services or anything that students might need to access during their education.
And how will you ensure that, I guess, addressing those barriers is there's like a diverse, I guess, collection of data, and there's a diverse collection so that the project has a lot of visibility in terms of addressing issues regarding the like very large LGBTQ 2S+ community.
We have been promoting the survey as widely as possible. We really want to make sure that we're covering a wide breadth of student experiences at Concordia. And in addition, we've also been, we did create some focus groups in which some closed focus groups. So for instance, we had focus groups for Black, Indigenous, and people of color only. We had focus groups just for trans people. And so we tried through these types of measures to ensure that there would be space for people to talk about their experiences in a way that felt comfortable and where their points of view were prioritized and taken seriously.
And where are you in terms of production thus far on the project?
Well, we're getting close to closing the online survey. So by the time this show airs, the survey will be closed. We are still doing a few interviews, and then we'll be at the data analysis portion of the project.
And so with the mapping project, you mentioned this earlier, you identified the current climate as, you know, a strong reason for why this project is necessary. So do you mean the climate in Montreal or the climate within Concordia specifically?
Well, both, but this project is specifically looking at Concordia. I think even the analysis of the situation at Concordia could be a much bigger project than the one that we're doing currently. I think that this is really, or realistically, this is the first step in that process, and I think a lot of the results of the project will probably point to other areas that need to be delved into a bit more deeply. But certainly, at the Center for Gender Advocacy, part of what motivated us to start the project was just the frequency with which we received reports of different problematic or oppressive situations that students were encountering during their classes or, you know, during some process of their education. Mm-hmm. So we felt a need to, you know, effectively map that out so that we could really show the administration concretely what these kinds of barriers look like so that they can start to take action on them.
And so why do you think Concordia specifically, I know you touched on this a bit earlier, but struggles to maybe harness a space that is inclusive and spaces that do support people with disabilities and the LGBTQ 2S+ community?
I don't think it's specific to Concordia. I think the reason Concordia struggles with it is that Concordia exists within a society that is ableist, homophobic, and transphobic. So it's a reflection of that society. And we are focusing on Concordia because, as I mentioned, we are an organization that is deeply rooted in Concordia. We're funded by Concordia students. Mm-hmm. So that was the reason that we're focusing on Concordia. But I think pretty simply it's just that Concordia reflects the greater society in which it is situated.
So why do you think there is this consistent norm where, you know, architecture does reflect ableist views and does, you know, seem to prioritize excluding numerous communities?
I think it's because people who don't face barriers get put into positions of power and decision-making all of the time. And then so when you know, buildings are being constructed or, you know, programs are being designed or whatever, the people who are making those decisions don't outside of their own life experience.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think, you know, oh, well, what would be the process of going through this building if I used a wheelchair or a walker or didn't identify as a man or a woman? And so I think that's, you know, it speaks to the importance of finding ways of allowing disabled people, non-binary people, trans people to learn the skills that are needed to be in those positions, and then to open those positions up to them and to give them the support they need to succeed.
So I wanted to focus on the other ongoing project at the Center for Gender Advocacy, which is the Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. So would you mind quickly summarizing the aim of this project?
Missing Justice is a campaign. It's been ongoing for many, many years. It's a solidarity campaign, meaning that it's composed of both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. And the focus is to work in solidarity with Indigenous struggles, specifically on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans, and two-spirit people. The current focus of the campaign is to organize the annual vigil that takes place on February 14th, Valentine's Day. This year that is a Friday, and will be a vigil and community gathering that will be happening at the Montreal Native Friendship Center. So that'll be a place where people can come together, remember those who are no longer with us, call for justice, and really honor those who've been taken. And we're really also looking at not glossing over what are the, you know, the root causes of that problem, namely that that we live in a society built on colonialism and genocide, mm-hmm. that is still rife with white supremacy. So apart from that, our campaign members are also engaged in a reading group to read through some of the reports about the various inquiries that have happened in the last few years, because it's important for people, and especially for settlers, to really understand, you know, the details and the specifics of what that problem is. So that's something that is happening on a regular basis, and if people are interested in joining that, they can get in touch with us.
Apologies, the interview did quickly cut out for a moment, so we're just going to move to the next question. If you would mind maybe touching on, you know, how, like, the colonial structure of Canada and, like, its legal system is related to the gross neglect of, you know, the racialized and sexualized violence that is being committed against Indigenous women for centuries.
So as I mentioned earlier, Canada is built on colonialism. It's built on the theft of land. It's built on the destruction of Indigenous people. And it's not surprising that violence, that murderous violence, is carried through to present day, regardless of whether, you know, Justin Trudeau occasionally puts an appearance of caring on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that part of you know, I think that there are many people who could speak on this much more eloquently than myself, and I don't purport to be an expert on this, but I think that it is part of what is difficult about addressing the current crisis is that we as settlers are incapable and unwilling to acknowledge our history, our colonial and genocidal history. And I think it's pretty difficult to address what is effectively an offshoot of that history, a continuation of that history, if we can't even acknowledge what it was and what it continues to be.
So on the page that discusses the project, it says that one of the goals, one of the agendas, is to apply pressure to the Canadian government. So how do you go about doing that?
I think one of the ways that we do that is organizing public events like this vigil, where we also do a march and vigil in October. I think taking public actions that signal to the government that that people care about the issue, that people aren't going to shut up about it, and that there is broad support for justice for the people who've been murdered or who've gone missing and their families and loved ones is really important.
And recently I learned that the number that was collected of survivors is not entirely accurate. How does the uncertainty of statistics surrounding this epidemic regarding Indigenous women impact public awareness and prejudice?
I don't know if I can answer the question of how it affects public awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the uncertainty around the numbers is largely a symptom of the problem, namely that police forces and authorities will often deem a missing or murdered person who is Indigenous to be the result of drug overdoses or suicide without really giving it a proper investigation. And I think it's also useful to include in our consideration of this crisis that even in the cases where those are factors, for instance, if a person died of suicide, that is also an issue of state violence. We know that there are epidemics of suicide in various Indigenous communities. It would be way too simplistic and naive to just think, well, there's just no real reason why that's happening. So we need to really acknowledge that that these are also important deaths to acknowledge as part of the problem. And with regards to whether it impacts certainty or support in the general population, I'm not really sure how to answer that. I think that most people do accept that that it is a problem. The inquiry was not perfect, but I think it did help to make people realize that it really is a systemic problem, and that so many Indigenous families and communities are affected by this crisis.
And lastly, what are ways for students to get involved with the gender advocacy projects in general? What are ways for people to get involved if they wish to?
If students want to get involved with the Missing Justice Campaign, they can email our coordinator. Their name is Dana Danger. Their email address is programming@genderadvocacy, that's all one word, .org. And for other types of volunteering, they can just email our, they can email info@genderadvocacy.org, and we'll connect them with the appropriate staff person, depending on what kind of involvement they're interested in.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Julie.
Okay, thank you, Amy.
That was our interview with Julie Michaud.
We are going to link the vigil. Oh, we've already linked the vigil event on our Twitter from last week's show. So just search for unfit_2_print to learn more or to say you're going to attend. Don't go anywhere because we'll be right back after this quick tune. Welcome back to Unfit to Print. That was Project Pablo with The Solution. We hope you found our interview interesting and informative. A huge thanks again to Julie for being on our show today.
So we want to thank our listeners again for tuning in to another episode of Unfit to Print. Catch us next week on 90.3 FM at the same time. And playing us out, we have Mountain of Ice by Final DJ.